Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Thanks, MOTAT. That's so nice to have a new sponsor. But yes, today we are joined by Sebastian Leutzinger because Alan could not join us today. So hello, how are you going?
Hi, very good, thank you.
Your first time on the radio?
Yeah, a little nervous there, but I'll get there.
Yeah. So the first topic is actually a great way to get to know you, Sebastian, because you've actually just published this paper. So it's titled Globally Consistent Influences of Seasonal Precipitation Limiting Grassland Biomass Response to Elevated CO2. Which is a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, it is.
So this has to do with how CO2 affects plants, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I tried to break this down into something really simple, because as you say, the study is actually quite complicated, and we won't have time to delve into the details.
Yeah.
But if I can make it really simple, so it's a global change in plants. Most people think CO2 is going to be a good thing for plants, and they're not wrong thinking that. So if you start from the beginning, CO2 causes warming, right? So plants are in a warmer climate and they will respond to that in some way or another. So some do well, others don't do so well. The second thing they experience is the elevated CO2, so they get more food, so to speak. So that's going to be a good thing. Nobody can say that's a bad thing for plants, but as we'll see, the study actually shows that it's not that simple.
Right.
So those are the first two. The number three is an indirect effect. So if I get more CO2, I can transpire less water, because as a matter of fact, I lose the water through the same organ, which is the plant pore, as I take up carbon. So if you give me more carbon, I can shut my pores a little bit and save water. So that means that plants in drier climates should grow better, right? Mm. Now, the study actually shows that it's drawing on data from around the globe, 19 studies that have looked at grassland under future CO2 concentrations. It actually shows that it's far more complicated than that. So what we find is that the way the rain falls during the year, regardless of the amount of rain that we have, influences this CO2 fertilization effect through very complicated pathways. And what the study shows is that in fact some grasslands do profit from elevated CO2, but others, and there's a few examples where the response is actually negative. And it's all got to do with how the rain falls during the year. So it shows that wetter springs promote this CO2 response, but if it's wetter during the rest of the year, it actually suppresses it.
Right. So whereabouts were you finding those negative responses?
This is based on 19 sites across the globe. And if you extrapolate this with a model onto the world map, you find individual spots where the response can potentially be negative. Very hard to explain how the mechanisms behind this work, but that's a fact. So I guess the bottom line is it's way more complicated than that. You can't just say elevated CO2 is great for plants, so let's emit more CO2. That's certainly a wrong conclusion.
So was the point of the study because of fears of rising CO2 levels with climate change? Is that sort of how the study came about?
Yeah. So plants are extremely important in respect to the climate, because they take up carbon. So the more they take up, the more carbon disappears again from the atmosphere. That's why it's extremely important that we understand how the physiology of the plant responds to this elevated CO2. And the fact is, it's very complicated, because temperature, soils play a role. There's all sorts of things that play important roles in these processes, and it's just, I guess my message can only be, because the study is really quite complicated, but the message is that elevated CO2 can be good for plants, but it needn't be.
Okay, cool. Moving on, there's this cool little story. MIT have published a study that suggests that by the end of this century, the oceans are potentially going to be changing color, so that tropical oceans will be bluer and more sort of mineral rich cold oceans will be greener.
Yeah.
What's this all about?
Yeah, so that caught my attention, because it actually goes back to a much more fundamental question, and that is, why, if you look at the planet from space, why is it blue and not green? So you look at the seas, and there is water, there is nutrients, to a point at least, there is sun, and plants haven't been able to conquer this space. So it's a very deeply fundamental, one of the open question still in ecology, really. It's not clear. It could be that the oceans are completely green. So why not, for example, have plants come up with something like floating islands? In the Life of Pi, you see this floating mangrove island. There's no good explanation, I believe, that this hasn't happened yet. And I tell my students, probably the reason is, it hasn't happened yet, but we're not, evolution hasn't finished. So maybe one day the oceans will be completely green. So, and now, this is really intriguing, I find.
Interesting. So what do you think, what are they saying is the reason for this changing color? Is it down to climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. These are, of course, very, very small changes in color, but, they eventually could up with the green ocean. So what they find is in the higher latitudes, there's more phytoplankton, so the ocean turns greener. And due to the warming in lower latitudes in the tropics, the ocean actually turns bluer, which is nice for the eye, but it's not so, there's less CO2 going into the ocean, obviously, by fixation of CO2 through phytoplankton. That's very interesting that, they observe that. And the study is fairly complicated and I'm by no means an expert at that. But I think it's really interesting that we're actually seeing something like a global phenomenon due to temperature changes in the ocean. It's also got to do with nutrients, of course.
Yeah, ecology is so... Yeah, I guess I'm learning now that it's all very complex. You are, by the way, I didn't actually say, but you are the head of ecology at AUT, which is cool. Fantastic area of science. Moving on, this isn't your area, but it was something that we were going to touch on. Researchers in the United States have found that in the immediate aftermath of Trump's election in 2016, like the 30 days, there was the 30 days prior, there was an increase in contraception use with American women, particularly the IUD implant. I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more about it.
Yeah. So this, when people come up with explanations of what happened, what is due to what. So these guys say that due to the fact that Trump was elected, the use of long-term contraceptives went up. And I'm looking at this graph, and it's on the radio, so not a good place to show anyone a graph. But so what they did is they compared 2015 before the same date. I think it was the mid-November or something. Mm. 20 days before, 30 days before, and then 30 days after. And as a matter of fact, even in 2015, you can see that during that time of the year, the use of long-term contraceptives seems to go up in the States. Now, more so in 2016. So because I teach statistics as well in the first year, and if you see a correlation, then move on to saying that things are like one thing causes the other. That's always tricky. And in this particular case, I think if there could be something like, before Christmas, use of contraceptives or long-term contraceptives goes up every year. And it happens to do that more so in 2016, when the year that Trump happened to be elected president. But for example, if they had shown more than just 2 years, and you can always see this uptick before Christmas, but they have no clue about the variation of that increase before Christmas. It could very well be just a correlation and not a causation. So I've been a little bit critical of this study there.
Oh, so there is room for criticism of its accuracy.
That's just my interpretation.
Right, because what are they citing as some of the reasons as to why is it fears of Trump's legislation surrounding contraception?
Yeah, but that's the thing. You can always find an explanation if you want to show a causation. Then you'll always find a reason why it should be like that.
Right.
They probably could have found a reason that proves the opposite or should show the opposite.
I may even seem like once they have the reason or like. They want to show something with the numbers, and the numbers do reflect what they want to show. And so it depends like which way they kind of... You can create a causal reason quite easily when you have a data set.
Yeah.
Which is really, really scary, but it happens quite frequently, and especially with often like medical statistics or like big pharmacy companies. I've seen that happen before. But... it has been interesting as well, because there have been recent concerns in New Zealand as well about stockpiling of contraceptives.
Really?
I think it's Levlin, which there was a shortage of. So I guess that could kind of buy into the Trump causation argument in terms of being like, well, what if there's a shortage, or what if there's somehow contraception goes out of business? But as you've said, it there's also a huge chance that, I mean, it seems odd that it's been picked up when there is that annual spike anyway.
Mm.
But
mm.
Yeah, wisely said. Yeah, yep.
Fantastic. That was Oscar, by the way. Hi, Oscar.
Thank you.
He's coming for the little chat. Perfect. Thank you so much, Sebastian. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. Cheers. Hope sometime in the future you'll come in again.
Yeah, less nervous now. Now that I've done it once.
Great. Thanks.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. Bang, bang, China.